I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is a sort of Brown University instant seminar, way jumping the 100 days gun to get our bearings in Obama time in the first 10 days of it. Glenn Lowry, the last time we talked in May of 08, Barack Hussein Obama's vital link with what we call the Black prophetic tradition had just been rudely interrupted in all that clash around Jeremiah Wright. To me, it's a vital question today. He's president of the United States. What is the organic link in that man's mind, body, and spirit to that tradition?
Well, May of 08 seems a long time ago, doesn't it? It seems another world altogether. Then I think the primary campaign was still ongoing, although Hillary Clinton was on her last leg. And one would have only, I think, with some trepidation, ventured to forecast that Barack Hussein Obama would be the next president. Now he's president. And it is a transforming fact. I've noticed this in many different ways. I know you asked me something very specific about the Black prophetic tradition, and I'll get to that in a moment, but I just want to say by way of preface that whereas the speculation about a Black man becoming president was a certain kind of intellectual parlor game that one could indulge oneself in, now the fact of the matter is that the commander-in-chief of the U.S. military, the chief executive officer of this massive government and huge force for good and ill in the world, the symbolic leader of the United States of America, the head of state with all of the ceremony and pomp that goes along with this, is a relatively young African-American man, and that is a stunning, amazing fact. So there is that. But I tell you, I worry for the Black prophetic tradition, and I'm skeptical about the connection of the President of the United States, who happens to be an African-American, to that tradition, not as a man or as a Christian, but in the office and with the responsibilities that he has. I wonder whether or not these are commensurate matters at all, whether they are denominated in the same units of currency, if you see what I mean, whether or not prophecy and the Black prophetic tradition really articulates with power and the exercise of the office of the presidency of the United States.
Glenn, what's your short form description, definition of the Black prophetic tradition?
Well, I think it's an outsider's critical, haven't yet drunk the Kool-Aid and don't believe the hype view about the United States of America. It's a historical narrative that takes the dispossession of the native people of this country as the great historic crime that it was. It's a insistence that this democracy, which of course has always been a complicated political compact influenced by wealth and property and race and all the rest, live up to the true meaning of the creed. And it's the recognition that even in the late 20th and early 21st century, it has not yet fully done so. It is anti-triumphalist vis-a-vis America's role in the world, deeply suspicious of city on a hill, yep, backslapping, yep, and self-congratulation. It's an outsider's critical assessment of what we do that sympathizes in a deep way with the struggles of those who are dispossessed, the Palestinians in the Middle East, just like the South Africans at the southern tip of Africa in a different decade. It says collateral damage when civilians are killed by U.S. military operations ain't just so much cost of doing business, but are deeply problematic offenses against a righteousness that we ought to aspire to, and so on.
Yeah, well said. It's a theology also, and a universal theory of freedom, with a strong anti-imperialist tilt.
And anti-racist tilt, and, yes, anti-militarist tilt, and maybe even anti-nationalist tilt.
Okay, the trick is to connect our president to that tradition through Jeremiah Wright or otherwise.
But I don't know if he wants to be connected. This was my original point. President of the United States is an office. The office has its own imperatives, quite apart from whatever an individual might do. I mean, when you're sitting with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and they tell you that we have a predator drone operation against some, quote, terrorist operatives in the tribal regions of Pakistan, and we want to take them out, and you've got to make the call, it ain't no time for quoting Martin Luther King or Frederick Douglass or talking about what the black prophetic tradition. It's time to decide whether you're going to kill these people or you're not going to kill them. And I think that the person who is the commander-in-chief of the United States of America, regardless of their individual biography, when placed in that position and forced to carry out those acts, needs to be looked at with clear-eyed realism for who and what they are. The commander-in-chief of the largest military force in the history of human experience, and not viewed through some rose-tinted glass with some kind of romantic and unrealistic narrative about the black prophetic tradition. I really wonder what they have to do with the exercise of the powers of the office of the President of the United States. Now, I could be wrong about this, but I remain to be convinced. I'm a skeptic about this kind of talk.
What does it have to do with him? Surely his biography, his history, even his complexion informs that man, president or not.
Okay, and so I think that's a variety of the question: to what extent can personality and individual personal morality really have leverage over the exercise of an office like president of the United States? Let me give another more prosaic example. Someone rises to be the chief executive officer of a large American corporation. Maybe it's ExxonMobil. Maybe it's Citibank or Bank America, something like that. That job is about making money for the shareholders. It's not about anything else. It's not about saving the planet. It's not about integrating the workforce. It's not about dealing with poverty. It's about making profits for the shareholders. Now, a person who has a particular individual experience and biography may approach the exercise of those responsibilities in a slightly different way. But something tells me they won't be the chief executive officer for very long if they don't make profits for the shareholders. And my suspicion is that the amount of leverage that they have to do good in the world is pretty minuscule relative to the imperative of making profits for the shareholders. Now, when you're chief executive officer and commander-in-chief of the largest military, when you've got a guy following you around with an electronic device that allows you to signal the codes to submarine commanders at sea with nuclear, multiply targeted warheads to release those weapons and to incinerate tens or hundreds of thousands, when you're that person, the imperative is to make profits for the shareholders, if you see what I mean. The imperative is to protect the interest of the American imperial project. And if you don't exercise your discretion so as to advance that imperative, you're not going to hold that office for very long.
Glendari, I want you to assume that the President of the United States in that office is not a robot. He was elected for a reason, and he's a man with a peculiar personal history and formation as much as Ronald Reagan or Abraham Lincoln or Franklin Delano Roosevelt or John Kennedy, and that it's going to show. What do you feel in him, not the office, of a critical capacity with respect to these questions of empire, of history, of justice in the world?
Well, it's a difficult question for me. If you were to ask me, what would be my take, my assessment of Barack Obama, Barack Hussein Obama, the man, given all I know about him, the books that he's written that I've read, the speeches that he's given that I've read, and the lore that has now risen around him, I think this is a man of compassion. I think this is a man with a deep historical sense. The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. I'd say he's a part of the bending toward justice. I'd want to put him in that category. I noticed in his victory address in Grant Park, the night that he won the election, he gave a very elegant speech in which he addressed himself directly to people sitting in, you know, small villages huddled around a radio, and he said, you know, a new dawn of American leadership is at hand. I believe he said something like, our problems are, our stories are various, but our plight is not, you know, separated. We're in the same boat together here. Things like that. So I think he's a person who would have more room in his philosophy for a concern about the poor, about the dispossessed, and all the rest. I'm sure that he's aware of the imperfectness of American democracy and of the inflated character of some of the rhetoric, even some of the rhetoric that he has himself to use as a matter of political expediency. Thoughtful, bright, you know, there's a lot of positive things to say. But the main point that I'm making here is that the office has its own imperatives, and that's the thing I think we have to take the measure of. Now, I could well be wrong. It could be that a single person of extraordinary personal qualities and depth of soul and breadth of vision can really transform the functioning of a government that has its own momentum and its own kind of natural movement. But I really got my doubts about that. And so I'm just trying to stay sober here and not get swept away with, you know, with fairy tales, Barack Obama and Martin Luther King, two ends of a spectrum of a historical enactment of justice. I don't believe that for a minute. And that's not a knock on Barack Obama. That's to me, that's like mixing the sacred and the profane. King's role is, in this metaphor, sacred, civically sacred. It calls America to account. His assassination is almost necessary in the tragic drama that is Martin Luther King at mid-20th century. It's almost necessary because the nature of his challenge, remember, at the end of his life, he was attacking the Vietnam War, calling it militarism and racism, and he was organizing poor people to shut down the government if necessary in order to get attention to their claims. That's attacking the system at its core. Martin Luther King, in that sense, is a sacred, prophetic figure moving through American history. Nobody who has to tell Iowa farmers that they're going to get fed whether or not the market will pay for their product or not. Nobody who has to tell gun owners that we're not going to take it, we won't pry it from your cold. Nobody who has to split the difference with Southern Republican senators who have the, et cetera. Nobody who has to stand in front of the Joint Chief of Staff and make sure that they say yes when he gives an order by not challenging their fundamental imperatives. Nobody can play that prophetic role. Let's not get confused. Let's not mix the prophetic and the sacred with the profanity of American politics and power and money and oil and nuclear weapons. They don't mix. They're not about the same things.
But you couldn't say money, oil, and nuclear weapons won the 08 election, Glenn. I mean,
I disagree with that, Chris. Money did win the 08 election. Barack Obama raised $750 million. He bought the presidency just like anybody. He only paid with small bills. Money did win that election. He can't say what he wants to say about the Middle East. If he dares, he once mistakenly said no one has suffered like the Palestinians, and he spent a year apologizing for having said that. He can't say anything that he wants to say in that office.
There was a moment, Glenn, early in his campaign, I think it was the spring of 07, he was in Selma, and he made an important speech and a direct connection between the freedom struggle in this country in the 60s that culminated in a certain way at Selma, and his own father's humiliation as a young Kenyan under British rule. And it was his link between his own history and the American struggle. Where is that in his head today, do you suppose?
Yeah, I imagine that it's in his head. I mean, that's what I was trying to say, and I really do want to be clear. I'm not saying that he's a Bush clone or that they're all the same. I'll bet that's in his head, his father's humiliation at British colonialism, the white supremacist philosophy that informed British colonialism and that also informed the racial hegemony that that lasted for a century after the emancipation in this country, I'm sure that Barack Hussein Obama vividly identifies with the anti-racist struggle throughout world history, sees his father's experience and his own, such as it has been, as a constituent part of that larger picture. I'm sure he does. I want to be very clear. What I'm saying is that he's the president of the United States. The office has its own imperatives. And the question is, how much can any person's, including his own individual outlook, break out of the mold and the framework and the kind of momentum that's implied by the office, which is embedded within a structure of power that is what it is?
Okay, I want to just assume, though, that elections matter and that people matter. In the case of President Obama, the other strand that I'm trying to reconnect is what he learned in Jeremiah Wright's church, Trinity United Church in Chicago. He was there for 20 years. He heard a great deal of that anti-imperial liberationist line. In your own reading of this man's formation, where is that now?
Oh, well, I don't know. I imagine that it's still there. I mean, it is kind of ironic because when Jeremiah Wright became the controversial figure that he did, the whole point was to communicate from the Obama campaign that he hadn't learned much at all in that church, that nothing of the fire and deeply critical outlook of Jeremiah Wright had penetrated. In fact, Obama, in that Philadelphia speech on race that he gave, said exactly as much. He said, and I can't quote him, but this is pretty much the gist of it, Wright's time has come and it has gone. His problem is that he's failed to notice that the ground has shifted underneath his feet and that America is not the country that it once was. So, you know, the whole point was to try to say that I thought in that damage control operation, which was that Philadelphia speech, was that this is a fiery and radical guy. He's a good man in many respects. But please understand that fire and that radicalism is of another era and it hasn't got anything to do with me. That's what I thought he said. So, you know, I'm not sure. I'm just talking to you now. Yeah. I'm not sure what you're after. I don't know. You know, what you expect. That Predator drone really did take out this Pakistani or Al-Qaeda bad guy and really did kill a substantial number of innocent civilians and really was authorized and ordered by Barack Hussein Obama. And that's what the president has to do. I'm not even criticizing him for that. I'm criticizing the view that you would expect him to do anything other than that. I don't.
I do, in the sense that he promised change, but that he opposed the war in Iraq from the beginning and to the end, in a sense. You're a little older than Barack Obama, and as a teacher, as a professional, you've seen a lot of young African-American people of his generation grow up under your tutelage. Does he remind you of any of them? Do you see his generation sort of finding its place?
Yeah, I do, and it's an interesting way of putting it, Chris, because I don't often think of myself as this elder figure looking back. Now the president of the United States is 14, 15 years younger than me and, well, could have been one of my students somewhere along the line. And it is it's a point. I think it's a good point that this post-1960s generation of African-Americans who had penetrated into the various citadels of elite achievement in American society, Harvard Law School or business school or whatever, are coming into their own, and Barack Obama is at the forefront of that. You know, it's a great thing, and it's you know, if I use the word affirmative action here, someone will get upset that I'm saying somehow Barack Obama or Michelle Obama didn't earn all the accolades that they receive from the Harvards and the Princetons of the world. And I don't mean that at all. But I do mean that there's a much larger number of such people who had opportunities because of affirmative action than there would otherwise have been. And this is one of the fruits of that effort to break open America's elite institutions to a wider, array of people. I don't want to take anything away from their achievements, not one thing whatsoever. In saying that, in a different America, in an earlier era, people like Barack and Michelle Obama would not have had the opportunity to prove what they're capable of doing. So that's a point that's worth making. But there's another, maybe a darker side or whatever. Co-optation is the kind of word that's floating around in my mind. And what I want to say is, the meritocratic game of getting to the top, the elitist game, my kid can only go to the private academy. Can't go to the public school because the people who run the world, that's where they send their kids. The Harvard, Princeton, Ivy League, they don't know nothing out in the Midwest game. Elitism, arrogance, hubris, a kind of class identification with the hierarchy of American society where we view ourselves on top, et cetera, et cetera. Again, please don't misunderstand. I'm not saying anything specific about Barack or Michelle Obama, about the Obamas. God love them. I do regret, and it's very unfair to them and me saying so, but I'm going to say it anyway, that they chose the Sidwell Friends for their daughters and not a charter school in Washington, D.C., that normal people would send their children to. I regret it because it struck me as a great opportunity to make a statement, but it's unfair because who uses their children to make statements? I get that completely. But let me just say, just as sending their children to a public school would have made a powerful statement, sending them to a private school also makes a powerful statement. So are we, you remember the speech by Frederick Douglass in the 1850s called Who's Fourth of July? Okay. Frederick Douglass gave a speech in 1854, the title of which was Who's Fourth of July, on the occasion of the 4th of July, 1854, in which he was making the point that to the, slave owning classes and their sympathizers and others in the American electorate, that you may be celebrating your 4th of July, but that we black folks have got a way to go before we can feel that it's our 4th of July. And there's a philosopher named Charles Mills at the University of Illinois who wrote an essay about the speech of Frederick Douglass, making the point that he doesn't mention the Native Americans a single time in the speech. It's 1854, and the extirpation of the civilization of the native peoples of this continent was still in its sway, still going forward. And Frederick Douglass's view, this is, hindsight is 2020, we look back with the benefit of 150 years, was that the founding fathers had intended that all persons were created equal to include African Americans, but on the occasion of giving that speech, it didn't occur to him to say it also included Native Americans. So here's a point that I want to make. As we African Americans climb the ladder into the upper echelons of American society, are we going to be able to maintain a sensibility that, carries this critique all the way home? Inequality of the opportunity for human development is a fundamental evil in this society. The fact that some kids who happen to be born on the wrong side of the tracks don't have a chance to be all that they can be because of the way that our institutions are arranged is a fundamental problem. Okay? Now, one of the first acts of Barack Obama upon arriving in Washington was to reaffirm that hierarchy, was to reiterate where the lines of opportunity are drawn in the society and what side of those lines he and his family stand on. It's very unfair to ask somebody to use their children as guinea pigs, unless, of course, they're being photographed in the midst of a optics display for an election campaign. Then it's quite to trot them out.
I hear this fear, anger in white and black critics on the left Juan Cole, the historian at Michigan who writes a wonderful blog, has from the first day of the Iraq War, says that Obama has begun the right promised withdrawal from Iraq, but he says the dark clouds over the Obama administration are the Afghans and the Palestinians. He says the U.S. will not be whole until Afghans and Palestinians can say, free at last, free at last.
Wow,
great,
I didn't see
God
that.
Almighty, I'm free at last.
Wow.
And black critics, too, are trying to reconnect President Obama to that tradition. What should we expect?
I mean, as soon as this interview is over, I'm going to JuanCole.com and find out what he said, because I haven't looked there in about a month. And sounds like Brother Juan Cole is shaking things up a little bit. I think that's well said. I see what he's getting at. That's kind of what I was trying to say in my own crude way not long ago. That, you know, when the Palestinians and Afghans, and of course Afghanistan is where empires go to die, is the cliche. Afghanistan is a deeply troubling and problematic engagement for us, and it could end up being Obama's Vietnam, Afghanistan, Pakistan. They're kind of interconnected. And Palestine, Gaza, refugees for six decades? A great military power, I'm talking about the Israeli Defense Forces, over and against basically a prostrate people. American weapons, cluster bombs, white phosphorus, F-16s. God, what a morass. For the United States of America. I'm not talking about Zionism, though. That they have their issues and they have their imperatives and they will do what they're going to do about their agenda. I'm talking about the United States of America. I'm talking about justice in the world. I'm talking about what side of history that we stand on. I'm talking about the ideological underpinnings for our posture vis-a-vis that problem in the Middle East. Okay? Is it neocolonial? Is it racist? I'm talking about the ideological underpinnings for our posture. Every time somebody utters the sentence, only democracy in the Middle East, every time somebody says special relationship, they're making profound ethical statements about the meaning of the American experiment. I'm not talking about Zionism. I'm talking about the American experiment. Okay? Let freedom reign. Let justice roll down like a mighty stream. We eschew and abandon racism and the domination of people based on ethnic or racial characteristics. We basically have an open border with Mexico because we won't be the kind of country that shoots people when they try to cross a river for opportunity. Okay? We have a constitution that says a civil authority, the government, the police, cannot be rooted on ethnic fealty or religious conviction. Okay? Now, in many ways, the experiment that's ongoing since 1948 and since a half century before in Palestine is antithetical to those values. We had damn well better figure out what side of history we stand on. And I just tell you this, Chris, if a black face is put on the American hegemon, it will legitimate the wrong side of history. Okay? So the ball is in Barack Hussein Obama's court, because if he doesn't come up with a different act than the act that we've been seeing, the net effect of that will be to etch injustice in deeper, to make it more stable and less susceptible to reform and change.
Glenn Lowry, let's be generous, let's be hopeful, let's be realistic in the sense that Barack Hussein Obama understood this game better than any of us.
Yep.
Or any of them out there. He bet against the neocon imperial trend in American life, and he won. How would you imagine him phrasing a redirection of the American place in the world?
Yeah, such an interesting thing to contemplate. And, you know, my prayer is that I am absolutely wrong. My prayer is that I underestimate Barack Obama by a substantial margin.
Which most everybody did.
So far, we've underestimated him. So he may yet rise to this occasion, and I will be simply in awe of it. He will be the Mandela of the 21st century if he manages to get it done. And how he would get it done, I mean, you know, how would I know? If I were that smart, I would be running something. You know, I'd have been able to get myself elected dog catcher somewhere. But... you know, I think of a few things. The war on terror, okay? It's right out of Orwell. It's right out of Orwell. Permanent war against abstract enemies whose shape shifts and whose definition is revised with each passing year. We're going to be at war forever, okay? It's got to be called off. The war on terror has to be called. The construction of the United States as a war. The president of the United States, the previous holder of that office, said he's a wartime president. This one can't leave office a wartime president. We can't be at war forever. The country can't take it.
You and I are smart enough to see that. Why shouldn't he be?
Well, yeah. Okay, and then can he get it done? You know, and I was just marking that as one of the indications of how we would know, you know, that he was getting it done. I saw this recent move about the salaries of the Wall Street people and all of that. That's interesting. You know, as an economist, I could criticize it as a little bit demagogic, as a little bit, maybe even more than a little bit populist, as not efficient market worthy and so on. But it really does shake things up a little bit. It really is sending kind of a wake-up call. It's not the kind of thing that you would have expected the last recent holders of that office to have done. But it's small potatoes compared to the foreign policy stuff that we're talking about.
You're right. You're right. He didn't mention the war on terror in his inaugural. He didn't call it off exactly either. He hasn't called off the empire. He doesn't use that word either. If there's anybody on the horizon, though, who might, it's still him.
Yeah. He said what he said about terror during the inaugural was interesting, and I don't take issue with it. He said, you know, your people will judge you by what you build, not by what you destroy. He said, we'll defeat you and we'll outlast you because we're stronger than you are. If you think that we're just going to cower and wither and go, you know, go under in the face of your slaughter of innocents, no, we're not. We're going to fight you back. That's all well and good. I mean, we ought to go and get the domestic terrorists who blow up federal buildings, too. The ones who kill abortion doctors, we ought to go get them, too. I'm all for fighting the people who would fly planes into buildings and slaughter innocents. Nothing wrong with that. He said, too, and hopefully, that if you just unclench your fist, you'll be met with an extended hand. That sounds right to me. How it's going to actually play out with the Iranians advancing toward being able to build a weapon, and with the Israelis asking for overflight rights over Iraq and bunker buster bombs to be able to take out Iranian reactors, we'd better just see. You know, I mean, we've been having this conversation here, Chris, and a thought in the back of my mind all along is, hallelujah, thank God somebody is asking the questions that you are asking in this conversation about the Black church and the Black prophetic tradition and its relationship to the president of the United States and the implications of whatever that relationship might be for the exercise of American power. Because it strikes me that these are the questions of our time. You know, I've been hungry for my fellow intellectuals, my Black studies gurus, my people who talk about matters of race and politics and philosophy, to plumb the depths of the question. And I've seen far too little said about it in the so-called mainstream media, or even in the higher tone, you know, more academic journalism. So at last, we're talking about the thing that I think very much needs talking about. And while I may not have answers for you, I'm glad that we can hone the questions a little bit here.
Do you find that Black intellectuals, you know, maybe in the bathtub, maybe over the kitchen table, are talking about it? Do you and your wife talk about it?
Oh, yeah. My wife and I talk about it all the time. I think she would count herself a black intellectual. My son and I, who's a second year at Haverford, talk about this all the time. I don't know that he calls himself either a black or an intellectual. And it's not because he's not descended from Negroes on both sides of his family. It's because he's 20. and we live in a new time. As has been pointed out by Barack Obama, amongst others, the younger generation have a different outlook on race. But in any case, yeah, we're talking about it, I think. And, you know, I imagine in the faculty clubs and all the rest, people are talking about it. They're waiting to see.
What's the mumble? What's the line?
Well, you know, after you get over the euphoria of a black person, the tears that have been wept, the celebration of American democracy, which has been well, reflected in Obama's rise. After you get over that, the question is, I think, the fundamental question is, not unlike what we've been saying here, how far can he go? How much change can he get done? Can he remain true to what we believe are his deepest ideals, even in the face of the constraints and the realities of exercising a power within the American system? And what does this mean, you know, symbolically and in role model terms, you know, for African-American culture? There's a lot of talk about young men having more hope about, you know, being more responsible and taking more advantage of such opportunities as do exist, given the example. Anyone can do anything in this world is the message that comes out of Barack Obama's rise and how that might be transformative for young blacks.
You raise a fascinating point. The era of black studies on every campus, which surrounds the time of Barack Obama's maturation and the building of a substantial black middle class with all the Ivy trims and all that sort of thing, raises the question of, what do they believe? What are the core attachments of that whole generation to their blackness, to the tradition, to Martin Luther King, to their brown and black people around the world? These are all open questions in my head, but we should be talking about them.
We should. I'm sitting here thinking about Martin Kilson. Martin Kilson, emeritus professor of government at Harvard, who was a tenured professor at Harvard in the late 60s and early 70s when the big brouhaha was going on that resulted in the establishment of African-American studies. And Marty Kilson was a critic of that advocacy. He was against it. He believed that the way that African-Americans needed to advance was through the disciplines, coming up and earning their spurs just like anybody else. He didn't want to see a separate side thing set up. Anyway, his thinking evolved. He's always been a man of the left, Martin Kilson. And the reason I'm thinking of it is because a book that he had been promising to write for years, and I don't think was ever completed, was titled Neither Insiders Nor Outsiders. That was the subtitle of the book. African Americans were neither insiders nor outsiders. Not insiders for the obvious reasons. You know, your nose is pressed against a candy store window. You don't quite have equal opportunity. But not outsiders either. Because we're going back 6, 7, 8, 10 generations, sons of the soil here, been as American as anybody could possibly be. And so therein lie the conundrum, the kind of paradox, neither insiders nor outsiders. Now, it seems to me that the central message of the last 25 years is that we're sliding into becoming insiders. Okay? What kind of insiders are we going to be? That's the question.
Question about a generation as well as the president.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Glenn Lowry, it is always a one-of-a-kind pleasure to engage with you. Thank you.
It's my pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Sarah Archambault and Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Listeners, feedback at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.